This episode is brought to you by Dreammakers, an amazing organization that comes alongside youth who have aged out of the foster care system by connecting them to our resources so they can navigate their life with help and support and tangible gifts. Dreammakersproject.org. Thanks to our sponsor, Seminary Now. Seminary Now is an amazing online streaming platform where you can get video resources to help you grow in your faith, from deep theological studies to lessons in social justice and spiritual integration. SeminaryNow.com/cuss and put in cuss30 for a discount for MLA listeners.
You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cuss.
I was first introduced to today's guest, J.S. Park, on Twitter. You know, Twitter, or X as it's now called, can be such a provocative place, so much reactivity there. In fact, what's interesting about Twitter is I'm often on there just to practice managing my own reactivity. But what's also true about Twitter is I've gotten to meet some amazing people through there. And one of them is today's guest, J.S. Park, or June Park. June is a hospital chaplain, and the way he tweets and posts about death and grief and pain and the way he engages it is just so poignant and beautiful. I wanted to have him on the show. June has written a couple of books. He'll be coming out with a new book in May 2024. This episode just confirmed to me that I want to get to know him more and have him back on the show. Just, he's so poignant, the way he talks about life. There really is something about death and trauma that boils everything down to its essence, and I think you're going to notice that in my conversation with June as well. Okay, so I just began the conversation simple enough, just asking him what his first day of chaplaincy was like.
Steve, my goodness, the very first day, that would be over 8 years ago now. You know, that first week of training, I can name two specific instances, so I'll try not to make a short story longer, but basically they gave us free rein on the first day. They said, just walk around the hospital. And so my supervisor had, there were five of us, five interns, chaplain interns. We walked around the hospital, and I don't know if it was a different kind of day, or now looking back at it, it probably is not reflective of every single day at the hospital, but there was just chaos all around in every hallway that I went to. You know, somebody screaming and yelling, somebody demanding to see someone immediately, security getting involved. And, you know, I work at 1,000-plus bed hospital level one trauma center, so we do see a lot of high activity. But it was almost like that first day I got sort of a super dose of what goes on in a hospital, a big hospital that's almost like its own city, you know, a very concentrated microcosm of trauma and high acuity crisis. And then I remember my first clinical, I shadowed a resident and we had to accompany a physician who was going to break news to this family that their loved one had just died in the ER. So I remember breaking the news to that family and their reaction. Their wailing shook the windows of that private waiting room. And, you know, I was just an intern. That was my first clinical. I think that was my very, very first patient and family experience. And I offered what little comfort that I knew that I could, both the resident and I, you know, taking the resident's lead, but both of us were there. And I remember thinking after years of, you know, I did 7 years of church ministry, pastoral ministry, and now here I am as a chaplain. And I never really felt like I belonged in church ministry the entire time. I always felt like an oddball. But here I am in this room where this family just found out that their most precious loved one had died. And when I started to be a presence and offer care and comfort, something in my brain and my heart knew I belong in this room.
Something that really surprised me about chaplaincy, I was not expecting this June. I just assumed my job was to connect to people in the worst moments of their life. Like, essentially, they're strangers, and you have to emotionally and spiritually connect to them, what, within 30 seconds to a minute. What surprised me was how the only way to do that was to connect to myself. All of this stuff going on under the surface in me that was like death and suffering, like, erupted the magma or the lava underneath. What was that like for you?
Yeah, you know, I got a taste of it in the job interview, essentially. When I interviewed for the internship, it was unlike any other job interview that I ever had, because they started asking really personal questions, you know, very almost surgical questions. Like, you know, the interview, you have to write a bunch of papers before you go in, like a life paper and like your faith and like, you know, how you came to be where you're at. And so that to me, it was already strange. And so me loving writing, I think I overwrote. I think I wrote like five or six pages. I was only maybe supposed to write two. I think it was single space maybe. But the head of the program, I remember his name's Wayne. He's retired since. But he asked me something like, so when your parents divorce, how did that affect you? And I remember trying not to move a muscle because I'm in a job interview. And at the same time, my brain, you know, starts suddenly on fire, like, is he allowed to ask me this? And then he said, you know, you mentioned in your life paper that you had a best friend in ministry who really hurt you. How was that for you? And I thought, how is this relevant to me getting the job? Because, you know, job interviews go like, tell us your greatest strength. Tell us the time that you failed and how you handled that. And, you know, that sort of thing. But they were asking me these personal, almost personalized questions. And so that's when I knew something was different about this. But the way I answered was so honest and so open, I was almost near the verge of tears. And I remember leaving that interview, driving around for about 30 minutes, because I felt like I had to dig up old injuries, and thinking I bombed the interview. Like, they saw too much. And I remember at the end of the interview, Wayne telling me, well, we'll call you in a few weeks. And that was a signal to me, like, I didn't make it. And then something like 2 or 3 hours later, I got an email saying, you're in, you're an intern, you're in the chaplaincy program. And that's when I knew, Steve, to your question, that the program was going to be about, if I am going to be of support and comfort and care in someone's worst moment of their life, that means being in touch with and digging into the worst moments of my own life. If I am to offer comfort and counsel for grief, how do I approach my own? And there, I've always believed self-awareness is found fully in the awareness of others. And to have awareness of others requires a heavy, heavy dose of self-awareness. It's a two-way street. And so I'm so glad that the chaplaincy program wasn't just about technique, practicum, doctrine. You know, it wasn't just about here are the ways in which you can become the most effective practitioner, but rather to become the chaplain that you want to be requires, and to serve other humans requires being in touch with your own humanity. And so that has always been the base of where we start and where we end. So that entire chaplaincy program was like, you know, it was a hyperbaric chamber of warp speed therapy. I mean, you probably remember, right? I'm sure those units, it was just constantly, like, I remember sometimes thinking like, hey, when are we going to get into this stuff about how to actively listen and how to control my body language? And there were things like that, you know, but it wasn't about the technique. It was really about how do I learn about myself? Because it's in being aware of ourselves, of our humanity, that we can then reach out to others.
So it's like they throw you into a context of death and suffering, and they talk about self-awareness. And then one morning, you're sitting in a circle with your fellow residents and your supervisors, and they say, let's do a verbatim. And you're like, wait, what? What is this? Would you explain to our listeners what a verbatim is? And then I've got a couple of questions about your own first couple of verbatims.
Yeah. You know, so I guess a verbatim is kind of like, if you remember in grade school, like when you'd have to do a book report, like you'd read a book and then you'd summarize it and then your feelings about it and, you know, where it moved you and then what are the themes and things like that. And so there's kind of a technical summary of the book, but then there's also sort of like, personally, how did this book move you and what did it tell you? What did it teach you? What did you learn from it? I guess a verbatim is a little bit like a book report with a patient encounter. And we were asked to do verbatims on a disproportionate reaction that we had with a patient. So in other words, if we saw a patient and there's something in their story that touched our story and caused some sort of emotional, psychological, or spiritual spike in our soul meter, then to sort of write on that and process what happened. Why did that little, my little heart EKG meter suddenly do this, you know? And so those verbatims were so important in that it's not just that I'm writing and processing, I'm also bringing it to my colleagues. And then they have the outside perspective to be able to offer their feedback and their take or their disagreement. Not all of it being equally valuable, but still being able to hear other people, whether they're encouraging or trying to admonish a little bit, like, well, have you thought about doing it this way? Or maybe it touched this part of your story that you didn't think about. And so I think it was C.S. Lewis who said, I can't see with my own eyes alone. It does take other people, you know, the awareness of others to have self-awareness. And so verbatim is a lot of a risk of vulnerability, almost like saying, here's this care that I offered in this very difficult situation. And now I'm bringing it to other people and I'm asking for your counseling. I'm asking for your feedback. I'm asking for ways in which I can improve. And I'm also asking for your support, because in some way this story affected me, this patient story affected me so much. And so verbatims sound almost like it's homework, but it's way more than that. It's almost like asking for connection from other people and saying, I want to be deeply connected to you so that you can tell me what could I have done differently, but also support me through my story as I wrestle through the pain of this. I gave you a very long answer, Steve, but for me, that's how a verbatim, I mean, it was so meaningful to me and I loved every single one that I did.
Mm. Yeah. And you would have done probably one a week or something like that during your year-long residency, I would think.
Yeah. Yes. We did so many. And you know what was so cool, Steve? I don't know if this is like CPE standard, but they gave us different formats we could do. Like, one verbatim, we could write it as if it were a screenplay. Mm. And then another one as if it were a novel. And then another one as if it were like, there was like our internal monologue. And then, you know, it's like every format, basically, we could change it up to keep it unique. So I don't know if our supervisor followed like the, you know, national CPE structure, but that made it really interesting and actually had to shift gears in my brain and my heart to really like, you know, and helped, I think, in understanding more and better.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things we haven't mentioned about a verbatim is that when you're not presenting one, you are then in the peer group helping your fellow resident as they present their verbatim. And my experience was I'm still very much processing my own life as I'm helping my fellow chaplain. It feels like a power tool in self-awareness and care.
Yeah, yeah. It felt like I'm opening up myself on the table to do surgery on myself, and everybody else, go ahead and join in. You know, it felt a little bit like that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one of the biggest surprises for me, I think I just assumed, I mean, I was 24, June, when I went in, so in many ways, I was still growing up, but I just assumed that the medical staff were so-called professionals, by which I meant they didn't get emotionally attached to their patients. And I was really caught off guard by how all of us, the doctors, the nurses, the chaplains, would profoundly get moved and grieve our own patients. I first noticed that in the neonatal intensive care, these preemie babies that these nurses were just all in on. A few years ago, when I was a lead pastor, one of my dear friends in our church died. He was the fourth of, we had an onslaught of young men in our church die, and many of them were very close to me. And I was in the room when he took his last breath. And then I was making a hospital call. It was like 18 months later after my friend John died, and I was in the same room. And a nurse saw me walk in. I'm just a lead, I'm a local pastor. This is years past my chaplaincy. And she sees me walk in and she has to leave the room. I'm just there visiting a congregant's dad. And later on, I went and tracked her down. I said, did I do something? And she said, you're John's pastor. That was a year and a half after he died. She was so attached to the family that she saw me and it triggered grief for her, and she had to leave so she could cry. She didn't want to break down in front of this other patient. That's phenomenal. And that was my experience as a chaplain, is I was always having to manage my capacity to hurt. Does that resonate with you, June? What was your experience, or what is your experience there?
Yeah, you know, Steve, I've never met a single healthcare worker that was not affected by the work that they do. You know, I think every individual, and this is outside of healthcare as well, we all compartmentalize to different degrees, you know, in order to cope with and survive the work that we're doing. And, you know, when I'm in the trauma bay of the emergency department and I see a physician have to perform a thoracotomy, which is opening up, you know, the side of the ribs and then doing the cardiac massage on the heart, it's a last resort effort to resuscitate a patient. When they do that, there is such an efficiency and precision there. And in order to do that, I would imagine, this is my speculation, that a physician would have to look at this patient as a body first in order to do that procedure. Because just looking at it, even thinking about it, it's a lot to see. It's a lot to do. And for this physician, they may have to separate internally who this person is, and then also I need to care for their body. However, I also believe, and having talked with physicians and nurses after the fact, that even when they're doing this and it looks like they're almost like automated, like they've done it before, or there's just such a precise movement in all of this, that still the trauma of doing something like that for a patient and seeing day in and day out the suffering and the blood and, you know, the insides of a body, that affects everyone. There's no escaping that. Even when it doesn't look like it affects them on the spot, we accumulate the entire sum of seeing all the suffering and the work that we're doing. And so I strongly believe, and Steve, I hope I'm answering your question, that, you know, we may see a healthcare worker look, you know, quote unquote, resilient, you know, or even rough and tumble. And if you work in the emergency department or level one trauma center, you know, or the surgical team, the OR team, you know, they all look pretty tough. But if you start talking with them individually one by one, you know that this work impacts them. It affects them, even if they don't want to admit it to themselves, that the work that they do comes out in a lot of different ways. It emerges from their life, from literally from their pores, in ways that are healthy or unhealthy. And so I'm of the opinion that, you know, when we read headlines and see so much violence, when we, you know, see the news and see so much of the chaos going on in the world, I don't think that's something that we can do with neutrality and passivity. You know, we can suppress it and try to deny it and we can try to squash it, but it's there in our bodies. And there is something that we need to do with it. So yeah, every healthcare worker I've met, like you were mentioning in the NICU, and I've seen them be all in and involved and engaged, you know? And so big shout out to them, social workers, you know, case management, psych. I've just seen them be all 100% in. I don't think I've met a single healthcare worker that I could ever say that can fully compartmentalize away from their work, you know? We're here serving other humans because of our humanity.
During chaplaincy, Holy the Firm by Annie Dillard. And that book, it's this tiny, I think it's 80 pages. People accused her of being on drugs when she wrote it. It's all over the place. But fundamentally, what Annie Dillard is trying to wrestle with is, what can we stand on for sure? With all of the suffering in this world, what can our hearts rest in as it relates to God? And I think most chaplains go through some cycle of belief and atheism and agnosticism and deism, some version of that, as a way of protecting our hearts. And, you know, like for me, I could never get past the fact that my faith says God can, but God isn't doing whatever. Talk to me about your own faith journey and how death and trauma and chaplaincy has pummeled or strengthened, or what faith looks like. It's a very open-ended question.
Yeah, Steve. You know, first I'm going to have to check out that book by Annie Dillard. I'm sure I would relate 100%. You know, I did at one point in my residency lose my faith, and I came back around, but different. And I think since then that's happened, the ebb and flow, sort of the back and forth, the tenuous and uncertain grip on belief. And as you mentioned, that cruise ship analogy is spot on. You know, I also did not grow up in the church, and was an atheist longer than I think been a Christian. And I think what I'm learning now is that when I came to Christian faith, particularly in an evangelical setting, what I'm understanding now in hindsight is that it felt often like in church and in seminary and in doing pastoral ministry that I somehow had to prove or hold up theology and constantly you know make sure that it could hold itself together. You know, like I was always proving it to someone, even in the preaching. Even if someone was hurt in the congregation, you know, I was always trying to make sure that, they're going to still believe, or, you know, they're going to still come to church or something like that. And I say that to my own shame. It just felt like theology was something that, you know, I was always like, I gotta keep this somehow, and putting so much energy into protecting and preserving that, you know, the dogma, the creed, making sure that I'm still publicly subscribing to everything that seminary taught me and in my evangelical camp. And so I made that switch hard from atheism to evangelicalism. And, you know, there's so much effort and energy exerted into preserving and protecting what I thought was faith, but I think was really just I guess subscribing or hold, like proving that I am part of the tribe, out of fear of losing community. Also feeling like I had to prove to God that, you know, I still believed and that I still believed all the right things. When I got to the hospital and I saw suffering, what I am now learning, what I've been learning, is that I am not interested anymore in a theology that I have to hold up. But, you know, when you burn that all away, when suffering burns that all away, what's left in the end is a theology that can hold me up, that can hold up my patience. And so what in the end is this theology that can carry us through? And so if it's certainly not the cliched statements and platitudes and, you know, spiritualized one-liners. I understand why people say those. Maybe it brings some comfort. You know, and some of those one-liners and trying to soothe someone, it's almost like they're soothing themselves too, right? But in the end, I think the way suffering has informed my faith is that I don't want to try to prove God anymore. Rather, I want a faith that I know when everything else is falling apart, when there is so much suffering, knowing that this suffering is not saying anything about my value and worth as a human being, that I'm still loved and that I'm still seen. And that this faith compels me to move towards those who are wounded and suffering, not to prove anything to them, but to be a presence. And so that's the faith that I'm keeping right now. That's the faith that's meaningful and valuable to me. So, you know, when I go on Twitter and I go online and I see people arguing with apologetics academics, you know, thank God for our scholars and thank God for people that really dive into that kind of stuff. And I was really into that. I was kind of into the heady wars of like, you know, well, we're going to split, you know, almost splitting atoms, like, you know, more than splitting hairs about, well, this interpretation and that thing. And now I just go online and I'm like, not to sound like I'm better than everybody or that I'm looking down on anyone, but I just can't get into that stuff anymore. All the apologetics and the debates and arguing. For me, it's just, hey, how's this theology going to work for me when I suffer and for my patients when they suffer?
Yeah, it's fascinating. When I did my CPE interview, I went back to one of our college placement guys. He's a good guy. And, you know, we're in more of a free church tradition. Our stream of churches isn't technically evangelical. We just look a lot like it. So people would lump us in that way, I guess. But he said, oh, that clinical pastoral education, that's kind of a liberal psychobabble. Like, he was very alarmed by it. And that's when I discovered that most of the high church traditions require it out of their pastors. And the low church traditions, like my tradition, we don't require it at all. We're suspicious of it. But I would go so far as to say, June, I don't know how to pastor without having looked death in the eye and grappled with my own mortality and my own fear. Because it feels to me like cooking a sauce or a roux. Like, it is boiling down to that essence that if God is good, God can only make sense in the room of death, you know? So for me, my faith is that, okay, death doesn't actually have the last word. And I don't know that for sure, but I believe it by faith. And obviously, like you, I've been around death a lot, and it does to me feel like death is very arrogant. It kind of, John Donne has that old poem, Death Be Not Proud. But yeah, my faith says, well, death kind of leaves the room in triumph, and then God says, ah, oh, there's another word. I've got another word. And, you know, it's like, I believe and help my unbelief.
Yeah. And, you know, Steve, I think out of fairness for all of that, I mean, death is terrifying, and I can get why ministers, you know, in particular, like evangelical pastors would want to rush past it a little bit or gloss over it. And I've said this before, but I think a lot of those kind of one-liners and platitudes, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for people who use that stuff, because death in itself, just looking it in the face, I mean, it is anxiety-inducing. It is fearful. It's horrifying to think that, you know, either you go or I go first. You know, it's a bad deal. You know, I have to watch them go or they watch me go. And so I think out of response to that, some Christian pastors, out of their own discomfort, just people in general, out of their own fear, will pull the eschatological curtain of hope over the present pain. And so they'll reach in the future hope over what's happening currently. And I think that is a way to self-soothe. And so for me, I do want to validate that people need something, hope or optimism or the future idea that, hey, like you said, death does not have the final word, and I absolutely believe that. And at the same time, I think bringing that so early into the picture, the timing of it, using that to kind of, you know, smooth over what's happening in that person's present is not going to be helpful for them. It's a form of denial and suppression. And so I think you're right, that the very foundation and base of my heart is Death does not have the final word. I don't believe that futures just end in a box. You know, I don't believe that, you know, I believe that we're all headed towards a life and resurrection. And when I see suffering as it is, knowing that we do live in a world where things break down, we live in breakable bodies and our minds can be broken. You know, living in a world where it seems like everything is haphazard and random, and it's almost like anything at any time can fall apart. You know, I do want to be present where someone is and not allow that fear to push me away, but to enter into that fear. And that's hard, Steve. So I really do sympathize with folks who might say all that chaplaincy stuff is whatever. You know, I worked also at a nonprofit for the unhoused for 3 years as a chaplain. And this was the same time I was working at the hospital. And I did trainings on trauma-informed care. In particular, how do we approach those families who are unhoused or, you know, considered, perceived as low income? And I've had people, I did these trainings for clergy, like pastors or church folks. I've had people walk out of those trainings because they didn't want to hear about it. They thought, you know, why do all this trauma-informed care and meet somebody where they're at? We're supposed to bring them the gospel. And, you know, it's like some of them wanted to be walking pamphlets. And I can see in that sort of snideness that I, at the same time, I had some compassion in my heart for them because it's like, yeah, talking about this stuff is hard. Looking at poverty, looking at trauma, looking at death, not easy. We do everything that we can to avoid looking it in the face. And at the same time, Steve, I believe that people do want to talk about it. And, you know, that's a conversation that people do want to have. Just how do we have it safely? And how do we validate that fear?
One of the things I think that marks a chaplain is the capacity to restrain yourself and your impulses. Like for me, when I was in the room of death, I felt this, I couldn't name it at the time, but I felt this need to speak to it so I could manage it, you know, control it. And so learning to constrain my temptation to say something, particularly when somebody was expressing their grief by yelling, "How could God allow this to happen?" You know, that the idea that they're not asking a question at all, but I'm hearing a question that I can give a theological answer to and then restraining that. What are a couple of impulses, June, that you find yourself running into again and again that you have to restrain in order to connect well with people?
Yeah. Steve, this is an excellent question because I, during my chaplaincy, I didn't know that I had this problem until chaplaincy pointed it out. One of the beauties of chaplaincy, right? And why I think everyone ought to serve at a restaurant for 6 months and then do one unit of CPE, everyone would be a better human being. yeah, you know, I learned from my supervisor that if we had an intense verbatim conversation or, you know, we would do IPR, which is interpersonal relations, you know, chaplains giving each other feedback and, hey, how are we doing right now? And, you know, gauging our trust level and all that kind of stuff. Very open, honest, vulnerable conversations, right? And it was almost like, you know, those at the restaurants when you get the little comment box, you know, leave us some feedback, you put the slip of paper inside. It was like we were doing that live with each other, you know, just open comment boxes. So I had this tendency at the end of a tense conversation fraught with friction and tension, I would say something like, well, you know, I'm glad that you were so honest and you told me this really good thing. And at least, you know, you got to get that out. Or I would say something like, you know, and I know that we're still okay. I would always try to smooth it over at the end, almost like I was wrapping up, you know, a 22-minute sitcom. And always I would just try to tie it up and make sure that we were okay, that we weren't tense, we weren't leaving any unresolved threads, no loose threads, nothing unresolved. And so I made these kind of comments, and my supervisor began to lovingly call it a June bow, you know, June being my first name. And I was just always bow tying everything. And they said, you know, when things get tense, you tend to jump in and want to make peace very quickly. It's like you can't stand the tension. Or I would use humor, and I'm sure nobody ever does that, as a coping mechanism. I would try to say something funny or crack a quick one-liner or something witty. And I'd try to turn whatever was happening into banter. And so I had to explore, why did I do that? Now, I wasn't necessarily doing this with my patients. However, subconsciously or in body language or that second language underneath that you don't really speak, but it's still there, I think it still was in some way. I was carrying that into the room. And maybe not every patient or their families were picking up on that, but I'm sure it affected how I provided care in that first year that I was there. And so if I'm, you know, earlier I was talking about moving to hope too fast, you know, I'm certainly guilty of that. And when I explored it, I realized I grew up in such a traumatic household filled with physical and verbal abuse. And I was a child of immigrants who they were doing, you know, what they knew how to do the best that they could. And on one hand, I know my parents love me. On the other hand, they struggled due to lack of resources and, you know, not being fully themselves that they could be because of growing up with so much devastation. So I say that to say my house felt like it was always like I went to bed with things hanging unresolved, like always this knot in my stomach, you know, are my parents going to stay together or not? And they did divorce when I turned 14. But it was always scary. I mean, a few times the neighbors called the police on my parents because they were arguing so violently. And so with that sort of turmoil, I had this need to write a happily ever after, the one that I did not get when I was younger. I just could not stand the tension. And what I had to learn, Steve, was to not try to fix or bow tie, but to actively listen and sometimes let that, in fact, a lot of times, let that tension sit and not try to speak into it, not try to wrap it up and bow tie it. And, you know, I know in many Western cultures, I think like silence or dead air or like not speaking, that's like frowned upon, especially if like you're in radio or if you're, you know, doing a show or something. I think in many Eastern cultures, silence is treasured and cherished. And so I had to go back to that, to the roots of that. Like it is okay if there is silence and discomfort and we're not speaking into things right now. And it is okay if we, at the end of this 22 minutes, we have to go into the next episode with the same issues. So I'm still learning that, Steve, but I do have to, as you said, use your word constrain. I do have to check myself on the temptation to want to crack a funny or, you know, to want to try to just resolve this right now. It's okay. I have to sometimes just say, this is as bad as it is, and this is what it's going to be right now.
Folks, I went to seminary in the 1990s, and in many ways, it formed and changed my life in ways that I'm still benefiting from today. One of the most powerful things for me was the way it helped me navigate scripture and make sense of it and get meaning out of it, but also the way it massively expanded my worldview. It's like it gave me more tools in my faith tool belt. What's amazing now in the 2000s, in the 21st century, is you don't have to go to seminary. There's an online streaming platform called Seminary Now, and some of those scholars that I read in books are now available to you and I in these amazing video courses. You can go to seminarynow.com/cuss and put in CUSS30 for a special Managing Leadership Anxiety discount.
We took a course, a didactic, in our chaplaincy talking about when your body signals you that you're not doing okay. And this was a course specifically for chaplains, first responders in general, but for chaplains in particular. And there was a whole thing of like symptoms you can expect. And when I read it, I thought, the work can't be that bad, can it? It was like bursts of anger, you know, if you punch the steering wheel, involuntary weeping, dark and depressing thoughts, nihilism. The list went on and on, like restless leg syndrome, cognitive fog, being unable to think clearly for hours at a time. restlessness, being unable to sleep, or being fatigued all the time. And so I think most people could say that they've experienced things like that just from any kind of life. It doesn't just have to be healthcare or, you know, being a first responder. But everyone also has a different biological rhythm and symptoms that emerge when life gets to be too much. And so I really had to keep track of that. And I know for me, my sleep is greatly affected by the work that I do. And so if I'm not sleeping well, and, you know, I'm not sure that I've slept well in 7 or 8 years, but things like that, where if I'm having a hard time sleeping, it's because I'm carrying a lot in my body. And then, Steve, there are times I do involuntarily weep, like I just can't stop. I mean, there are a couple shifts where for days after, you know, I may be sitting reading a book and I'm not even in my mind or heart sad, but my body knows that it's carrying something. The body knows and the body remembers. And so that is personally for me. But speaking to anyone who is listening, I think it does take a bit of an awareness check to ask ourselves, like, how do I know when my body is feeling shame? Or how do I know when my body is feeling sadness or it's accumulating too much? And that's a signal for me that I need to change routine, do something different, take care of myself, process this with someone. For me, I take medication and I'm in therapy. My therapist just retired, by the way, so I do have to find a new one. That is its own grief. I'm very lucky that I get those resources. But I think it is sort of, it's on each of us, I think, to kind of discover, like, what are my rhythms? You know, when do I know that I need to unplug or plug into something?
June, I typically wrap up the episode with my notorious gauntlet of anxiety questions. I know you came in today terrified of what might come that way, but this whole interview has kind of been a gauntlet. So what we're going to do is I just want to wrap up with one question. I first discovered you on Twitter. I know Twitter is a hit and miss place, but for me, it's been an incredible place to learn and meet good thinkers. And there is a beauty and a craft to your writing that deeply moves me. It's the primary reason I asked you to come on. I mean, aside from the chaplaincy in common, but the way you communicate is, it has a beauty to it. And I guess I was curious, that's such a gift to us. You've already written a couple of books. You've got a book coming out in May. I think we're going to have you back on closer to the release of that book. I would love to just spend more time chatting. But does writing, is it a way for you to be soothed as well? Is it a gift to you as well? Because there's something really inviting about your writing. I'm just curious what it does for you.
Yeah, you know, even alluding to what I was saying earlier about how we take care of ourselves, I love writing. You know, I've been doing it, I think, my whole life since I've been able to speak English, you know, which wasn't until maybe 5 or 6 years old. But in my quest to, like, learn how to speak English really well, I just carried around a notepad and wrote everything that I saw, and I discovered that I loved it. And, you know, I write so much that the stuff that I write online is maybe just like a half or even a third of what I write for myself. You know, journaling, I've moved now to writing on my phone. But I think just every one of us needs some sort of outlet or way to take care of ourselves. And for me, it's storying or being able to narrate what is going on within me and to be able to kind of look back in hindsight and make meaning and make sense of what is happening and what I am doing. And so that is healing in its own way. And I didn't know that when I was writing, because I didn't write online with the purpose of, oh, people are going to be interested in what I'm saying. I just did it because I wanted to share thoughts. And I thought, hey, if one person reads this and goes, oh, I'm not alone in this, then that would be great, you know? But it seems like I mentioned earlier, people do want to have the conversation about grief and loss and death, as uncomfortable as it is. And I think the reason anyone is, you know, reading my stuff very thankfully is because they want to have that conversation and they want to think and talk about it. And so, yeah, Steve, I absolutely love writing. It's a lifelong thing. And I feel like I can't go a day without writing.
Oh, let me wrap up with something, just a two sentences you put on Twitter. You often write these threads on Twitter. The context of this was you were talking about one of your patients who couldn't find her husband, and you were trying to help her locate her husband, only to discover from her husband's brother that he had died a number of years ago. And here's what you put. You said, "I think she was signaling something true about grief. By forgetting her husband died, wasn't she somehow remembering him? Her mind couldn't recall, but wasn't her body grieving the way it needed to by remembering through the loss of memory?" Man, did that just struck me dumb, June. So as we wrap up, I have run us out of time. I'm definitely going to be hunting you down for another interview, probably closer to when your book comes out. This has been a delight for me. My guest is June Park online. He's known as J.S. Park. I'll have links to June's books and Twitter and Instagram, where he does most of his posting. June, what a gift this has been. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Steve, thank you for your kindness, for your encouragement. Appreciate you. Love our time together, and would love to chat with you anytime again.
For more resources, visit stevecusswords.com or missyoualliance.org.